It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. There are only about 880 mountain gorillas left on Earth. With such a small population, the health and well-being of every gorilla matters if the species is going to survive. My next guest is Dr. Michael Cranfield. He's a graduate of Iowa State University's School of Veterinary Medicine in 1971. He is the director of the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project and co-director of Gorilla Doctors, a group of vets that provides health care to mountain gorillas living in the wild. He'll be speaking at the vet school at Iowa State this afternoon at 5 o'clock. And he is with me now. Hello, Dr. Cranfield.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
I think a lot of people know at least a little bit about mountain gorillas because of the work of American gorilla researcher Diane Fossey, who was murdered in 1985. Her story, of course, was told in the wonderful movie Gorillas in the Mist. And this project, this Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project, actually began with her, right?
That's true. The Gorilla Project, the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project, exists for two reasons that involve Diane Fossey. One is that she, habituated many of the animals, and that means that she kept going closer and closer to them, and until they showed no fear of her. And that then allows tourists to get very close, and it also allows trackers and guides and veterinarians to monitor the health and treat them. And the second aspect with Diane Fossey was that she started off as a behavioralist, but realized that the animals she was studying were disappearing. And they were down to about 240 animals in 1985. And she asked Ruth Kiesling if she could go back to her father, Mark Morris, of the Morris Animal Foundation, and provide veterinary care on the side of the mountain. And in 19, she actually died before that occurred, but Ruth stayed true to her commitment and put Jim Foster, the first veterinarian, on the side of the mountain. And at that point, he was considered to be the first veterinarian that treated individual wildlife in their own habitat. So it was a pretty amazing, it is amazing program, but it had an amazing start.
And you mentioned that there were about 240 gorillas at that time in 1984. There are about 880 now. Now, that is by no means a secure population, but is that a testament to the success of this program?
Yes, it is. I'd have to say that with a little caveat. The park that she worked in was the Virunga Massif, and it had 240 in 1985, and it has 480 mountain gorillas. But there is another park called the Bwindi Impenetrable Forest that's totally in Uganda, and it has about 400. But the population has doubled. The population is the only population of great apes that is growing. It is growing at right now at 3.8%, which is as high as the human population is growing on the face of the earth. Now, there is a lady that published a paper called Extreme Conservation to try and look at the reasons why this phenomena was happening. And she saw, through computer modeling, she saw that the veterinarians were responsible for 2% of that 4% of the growth. So we are quite pleased with the outcome.
How did you get involved?
Well, I'd been working at the Maryland Zoo in Baltimore for several years, and I had realize that I believe the role of a veterinarian in the zoo is to take problems that are causing health problems that are causing conservation issues in the wild and use the inhabitants of the zoo to develop better diagnostics and treatments for these animals. And I'd also done some work with primates in the wild and realized that the populations were being devastated at a great rate and that perhaps it would be more rewarding and beneficial to the conservation world to actually do the work in the wild. So unfortunately, the first veterinarian, Jim Foster, who's an amazing man, had a heart attack in Rwanda and died, unfortunately. So his job came up, and I thought, well, this is kind of a really nice fit. So I applied and was lucky enough to be chosen.
The idea of providing veterinary care to a wild animal as large as a mountain gorilla seems a little overwhelming to think about being able to provide any kind of health care to a wild animal that is so much stronger than you are. How do you go about this?
Well, it's a very good question. And it has partly to do with the behavior of the gorillas, their mountain gorillas in particular. They're very passive animals. Now, they do have great strength, and they do have the capability of great damage to their foes and to people. However, when we go up, they are habituated so that we can get within about 7 meters of them, which is pretty close. And we isolate the patient that we have to deal with away from the silverback or the protective father. And then we use these plastic darts that are silent. And if the animal doesn't scream, then everything usually goes smoothly. And we have trackers and guides that will make a circle around the animal that we're treating, and they'll keep the other animals away. Now, if the animal screams, it obviously alerts the silverback. And there'll be probably about 4 or 5 minutes of sort of panic activity until the silverback realizes that, no harm is really being done. We're not taking animals away. We're not hurting them. And then they usually calm down. So it's something that is sort of species-specific, actually, because I don't think that we'd be able to do that work with chimpanzees without getting injured.
Do you think that the gorillas actually understand that you are trying to help?
I don't like to be anthropomorphic, but I really do, because you see the silverbacks. They will just get to a distance and sit and watch the whole process, and very quietly. And they do have the power and the ability to come forward and grab the animal and carry it off if they wanted. So I think there is some sort of understanding. I'm not sure how deep it is.
What kind of health care are you providing? Can you give me some specific examples?
Yeah, there's two main areas that we provide clinical care for. One is trauma, and it's usually from snares that are set to capture animals for food, so it's poaching or bushmeat. And they're not actually after the gorillas. It's taboo in East Africa to eat primates. So the poachers are not after the gorillas. They're after the other animals that are in the gorillas' habitat. But unfortunately, the gorillas often get caught in them. And this will, at best, cause them to lose a limb, at worst, cause death. And so we go in as soon as there's a snare and get it off as quickly as possible. And the second most common clinical case is upper respiratory diseases. And they're on fairly high up in a rainforest on a mountain. It's fairly cool. And so they do develop colds quite frequently. And some of these colds we have proven are coming from humans, and they have not been exposed necessarily to them before, and they can have quite a devastating effect. Now, obviously, colds are usually caused by viruses, but it's the secondary bacteria that usually cause mortality. And so we will go in and dart those animals with antibiotics. And because there's very little antibiotic resistance in the bacteria of the wild population, they respond amazingly well.
Can you tell me the story of a more extreme case that you've had to deal with in a specific situation?
Okay. What happens in guerrilla politics is there's silverbacks that run groups, and those groups can be anywhere from 3 animals to over 50 animals. And they're always vying if a silverback has a great number of females, then often other silverbacks, lone silverbacks, will come in and try and steal animals. And so there's quite a lot of interactions between silverbacks. And there was this one juvenile named Emoja, a young juvenile, and her mother had lost a hand to a snare and actually had lost an eye in another injury. So she was a little bit sedate and grumpy. So Emoja would spend time with the silverback most of the day. Well, this silverback ended up in a fight against another silverback, and Emoja was sort of in the middle of it and got pretty badly injured. And the group we obviously wanted to go up the very next day and anesthetize Emoja and see what was going on. But we were only able to take pictures, and because the group was still very, very upset from the fight, the interaction that happened the day before. So we brought back the pictures, and we examined them very closely, and it appeared like there was a hole in the wall of the abdomen, and the intestines were actually being exposed to the outer air, which would usually be a cause of death. I mean, it would cause the animal to die fairly quickly. However, we were able to get to it a couple of days later, and lo and behold, it was intestines that were out. We debrided the wound and washed the intestines, put them back in, and sewed the animal up. It also had a broken leg, and so the animal was taken back by its mother and is alive today.
Wow. Do you ever remove an animal from the population and then reintroduce them if they need extreme care?
No, we don't. We do all our work in the field, which means that we have to sort of have an idea of what we're going to be treating and then take all the equipment for that treatment up with us. And that can mean hundreds of pounds of equipment if we need to do an x-ray or an ultrasound or even just a long anesthesia on gas. We need to take oxygen with us and the anesthetic machines. So it's a little bit tricky. The only time that we work on gorillas that are outside their habitat is if they're orphaned animals. And these animals are ones that have been poached by people trying to sell them to make money. And they often are in poor condition when they come to us because the poachers have had them for a fair length of time. So we nurse them back to health, and we now have some pretty wonderful sanctuaries for them.
And they cannot be released back into the wild population?
That's an excellent question. It's always tricky to release animals back into a population because they've been exposed to a lot of human diseases that they normally wouldn't be exposed to and could actually be a threat to the population. So at the moment, there's four mountain gorillas, orphan mountain gorillas, that are in a nice sanctuary in Rumangabo. And because the mountain gorilla population is so robust, it's unlikely that we would take the risk to that population by releasing these four individuals. Now, they're in a very, very nice situation that's even going to be expanded further and may become sort of a satellite population in case there's some devastating effect to the main population. That said, there's a small population, a very small population of eastern lowland gorillas in a place called Mount Chabarimu, and that's a pretty isolated habitat, and the numbers have gone from 20 down to 6. And we do have quite a few eastern lowland orphans, and so that is now becoming a center of focus that we may be able to supplement that population, mainly because the population probably will not be successful in the future unless we do. And also, it's an isolated population that's not going to be able to spread any diseases to a great number of animals.
Now, speaking of diseases, of course, many of us are following the news of another Ebola outbreak in Africa. Is Ebola a threat to mountain gorillas?
Yes, it is. The lessons have been learned from the western lowland gorilla and the chimpanzees in the region of West Africa. There's been hundreds of great apes die from Ebola. So we are very, very nervous about Ebola being in the region. And it has been within about 200 miles of the gorilla habitat. And also, the advent of spelunking in Africa is growing. And the carrier for the Ebola virus is thought and actually proven to be bats. So we're very, very nervous about people going to bat caves and then coming into the gorilla parks. So it is a big threat. Now, the nice thing is that because about 70% to 80% of the mountain gorillas are habituated, there are vaccines being developed. In fact, there's one that has been challenged and found to be fairly successful, that we could, if necessary, go in and use the vaccine in the face of an outbreak. Hopefully that will not be the case. And that was proven back in 1989. When there was an outbreak of measles in the population, and the veterinarian at the time was able to go in and vaccinate a ring around the original case and stop the outbreak.
We just have a couple of minutes left. You're working with these two populations of mountain gorillas. You have seen significant increase in the population, but still 880 individuals left on Earth. That is a precarious situation for any species. What are the greatest threats to mountain gorillas right now?
I think the greatest threat, there's actually in Rwanda alone, there's over 28,000 tourists a year go into the park and see these gorillas at close range. So we're very, very concerned about introducing devastating human diseases. There is some habitat changes that are coming about that may shift the vegetation. We're concerned about that. But really, it's disease is the main threat. Now, if we look at gorillas in general, it's habitat loss due to logging and bushmeat. But because the mountain gorillas are in two protected areas, that's not our major threat. And you have to understand that they have over 98% the same genetic makeup as we do, and so they're highly susceptible to the human diseases. So I guess the next question that most people would ask is it worth having tourism? Well, tourism brings in, with ancillary income, it brings in about $250 million a year to Rwanda. So it is significant and it is important, and it's probably why the gorillas are getting as much attention as they are. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, and that's our job to sort of mitigate the problem down to the lowest risk.
Gorillas, of course, are unique, and the societies that they live in, the fact that you have these two isolated populations, do you see this as a method that could be replicated with other endangered species?
Probably not to the intensity that we're using in mountain gorillas. It's a very expensive process per animal, but again, these animals are earning their own keep, so to speak. But we always look to, when we're designing health monitoring programs for computers and stuff, we're always thinking of how we can make it so that it can be utilized in other species. And yes, I think that some of our programs, like employee health programs for conservation personnel, can be utilized in other sites.
Dr. Mike Cranfield, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Mike Cranfield is a graduate of Iowa State University School of Veterinary Medicine. He is also director of the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project, co-director of Gorilla Doctors. And he'll be speaking this afternoon at the Vet School at Iowa State University at 5 o'clock. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow, it's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa.